This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Economists. I'm Peter Martin.
And I'm Gigi Foster. Hello.
Gigi, throughout the pandemic, we're finding solace in nature. Yet the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says the climate is changing near inescapably. And there's more. I want to read to you from the foreword to a report commissioned by the UK Treasury into the economics of biodiversity. It's known as the Descripta Review. It came out in February. Today we find ourselves, together with the livestock we rear for food, being 96% of the mass of all mammals on the planet. Only 4% is everything else, from elephants to badgers, from moose to monkeys. And 70% of all the birds alive at the moment are poultry, mostly chickens, for us to eat. We're destroying biodiversity, the very characteristic that until recently enabled the natural world to flourish so abundantly. My point here is that we as economists, the economics profession, have largely missed this. Perhaps for understandable reasons, our focus has traditionally been on income and production, the so-called GDP measure of gross domestic product. As a sort of measure of growth, I suppose, it might have misled us. Here's how the man who led the review, Cambridge University economist Sir Partha Descupta, describes it.
So if you're missing out something, it's almost like a house in which you're buying fancy furniture every day to make the inside of your house very beautiful. When the roof is on the point of collapsing, your floor is sinking, and you don't have any foundations.
Is he right? Do economists make lousy accountants, Gigi? We've been so fixated on income that we've ignored or hugely underplayed the destruction of the resources we need to drive that income.
Well, the most popular measure of a country's economic success, as you say, Peter, the GDP, measures only what's produced or consumed today or last month or last quarter when it's reported, without taking account of the sustainability of that production or consumption. GDP can even count as good things events that are unarguably bad for the environment, like the Exxon Valdez oil spill, you may remember, in Alaska in 1989. That spill created a lot of work, which was counted as production, for people who did the cleanup. So it was a good thing.
And the bombing of London, too.
Exactly. Post-war rebuilding efforts are hugely positive for GDP, which by implication means that war is a good predictor of economic success, which of course is a bit of a paradox. But on the other hand, the GDP measure was developed in a very different time. It was a time when it may have seemed as if the resources we depended on, like the oil spilled by the Valdez, were inexhaustible, and that nature and the oceans were strong enough to deal with the pollution.
Gigi, you're a professor of economics. I'm an economics editor. Can I raise the stakes? It isn't just that economics has emphasized the wrong things, and that's sad. You know, if you were looking at art history or some other discipline, it emphasized the wrong things, that would be merely unfortunate. It's that economists are influential. The people you train, the people I write for, absorb what's basically a faulty way of thinking about the world and act on it. In corporations, in politics, in business, our mistakes matter.
Well, I agree with you about that, Peter. Our mistakes do matter, but I think actually that economics has done more than any other social science or business discipline to offer real-world practical solutions for environmental problems. So we may not count sustainability in GDP figures, but economics has delivered many game-changing solutions, which range from the guidance in managing common pool resources like fisheries that was offered by Eleanor Ostrom, as you know, one of only two female Nobel laureates in economics, to the cap-and-trade emissions trading systems that are used around the world today and have been for decades, and they significantly reduce pollution. So I don't think that focusing on those kinds of practical market-based solutions is a faulty way of thinking about the world, but I agree with you that GDP is a far from perfect measure of what we as humans care about.
It's a far from perfect measure, but it's the one that we and governments, Bureau of Statistics, the politicians keep focusing on. And I wonder whether we should have serious reflection on that. And I wonder it more after reading the Descripta Review. On The Economist on RN, it's time to bring in Diane Coyle, now the Bennett Professor of Public Policy at the University of Cambridge, and one of the leading thinkers about what economics is and what it should be. I can recommend her new book I've just finished, Cogs and Monsters, and also one of her earlier books, GDP, A Brief but Affectionate History. She's working on the issues raised in the report. Diane, thanks for joining us from London.
It's a pleasure. Hello.
We get people writing to us all the time saying the whole concept of economic growth is wrong, and it really annoys me. They say you can't grow forever in a finite world. And I write back, or we've said on the radio program, yes, things can get better forever. Resources needn't limit growth. You might use fewer resources, or you might use the inexhaustible resource we've got, ingenuity. We can make life better without using up things. But the critique raised in the Descriptor Review of Biodiversity is a different one, isn't it?
It is, and it says really that we have been ignoring, not counting in any of our economic measures, some of the resources that it turns out are going to be fundamental for our own futures. And that's all of the range, the variety of different kinds of life on Earth. And they have been left out of what economists call the production boundary. We've not counted them as part of the economy. You were talking about GDP and how that has come to be the single measure of success. And one of the things that leaves out is what happens to your assets as when there's a natural disaster or a war. But it also leaves out assets that are used in the current period. And that includes all kinds of things like unpaid household labor or volunteering that we might care about, but also these natural resources. If they get turned into production, you know, a farmer grows crops and that's sold in the market, that's part of the economy. But the variety of nature that the review covers is not counted, and it turns out has been depleted to the point where it's going to significantly affect our future well-being, both economic well-being and more broadly understood. That's the significance of this review. It argues really powerfully for bringing nature into the economy.
What sort of things that were previously regarded as invisible and free and limitless and therefore not worth counting?
Well, in the biodiversity arena, one example would be changes in land use that are affecting species habitats and creating interactions between humans and other creatures that have led to the emergence of zoonotic diseases. The coronavirus is thought to be one of these, and there are previous examples like Ebola. So that's one immediate consequence of not paying attention to the impact of our activity on biodiversity and habitats. But another, much less visible even, would be what's happening to all the critters in the soil and methods of farming, intensity of grazing and land use, application of fertilizers has reduced soil biodiversity and soil quality. That's going to have an impact on agricultural productivity and our ability to feed the number of people who are living on Earth. And so we obviously need to start including in our measures of economic success these natural resources, biodiversity being one, much less talked about than climate change, but actually with equally powerful consequences for our future.
So, Diane, I just want to ask, the countries that are caring about biodiversity, just like the countries that are caring about the cleanliness of the air or the oceans, tend to be the ones that actually have the highest GDP per capita. We get, I suppose, more finicky and we start to care about things beyond just whether we can feed our families. I mean, is there a tension there then between continuing to grow such that countries gain more GDP per capita and start to then care, their populations start to care about things like biodiversity versus halting our growth or our depletion of resources and then perhaps not getting to the point where most of the world cares about these kinds of sort of unseen resources?
There is a tension, as you say. It's a kind of luxury for rich countries to be able to stop worrying about income levels and feeding people. But there are opportunities to improve people's well-being that don't show up in GDP and growth figures by caring about environmental factors. You know, even in low-income countries, things like the quality of air, think about the air quality in Beijing, think about the environmental movement in China and the appreciation there that the race for GDP growth, effective as it has been in vastly reducing poverty, has had some real consequences. And then the trade-offs start to look a little bit less acute in some cases. And there are also solutions that economists have devised that actually help ease that trade-off as well. I'm thinking of something called payment for ecosystem services, where governments can establish schemes that actually produce income for people by paying them to deliver benefits for nature. And there are examples such as reforestation in Costa Rica, where it's enabled the development of a tourism industry and created incomes for people. And so it's aligned the incentives, to use an economist term, so that you can do things that are good for nature and good for people's incomes as well.
You're calling what you're doing the Wealth Economy Project. What do you want the outcomes of that to be?
The Wealth Economy Project is really picking up on the points you were making at the start of the program about needing to think about assets. The reason it's important to move from just thinking about GDP to thinking about a nation's whole balance sheet across all the potential assets it might have is that it embeds sustainability. So we stop thinking just about growth this year and we start thinking about the long-term future. So just as in financial markets, investors think about a whole portfolio of assets and what are their correlations with each other, which ones go up and which ones go down, and how does that affect your total return? You'd be thinking about the same thing in the national context. So you'd be thinking also about the quality of collective decision making, the social capital that enables economies to thrive, that economies kind of shy away from because it's a bit ill-defined and hard to measure, but is fundamentally important to how well countries do.
That is, in fact, what biodiversity is. You can think of it as like having diversity in a portfolio. You never know when you might need something, a particular plant or drug, and without it, you might be weaker.
Exactly right. The received wisdom is that the more diverse your portfolio, the more secure your future is going to be, and it's just the same.
Are we going to have to go beyond accounting, though, which is what your project is about? Pata Dasgupta has talked about an international body that charges for use of the ocean at its cost to the world, and using the large amount of money raised from that to pay countries to stop logging. Are we going to need a change in institutions?
I think so. But of course, it's incredibly difficult to get these institutions operating globally. And the international institutions we have date from the period after the Second World War. We've been seeing with climate change over many years that the framework we have for that isn't working very well. And so it's quite a leap to think we can add another institution that's going to start charging for the oceans. And you can just imagine the kind of negotiations that would be involved. I think as a matter of practical change, we're going to have to start at the national level with countries doing as much as they possibly can themselves. And of course, you know, as Gigi was saying, with a particular burden on rich countries who can afford to make more short-term sacrifices, if you like, in order to deliver these long-term investments in the human future.
It's been very hard to get countries across the line on climate change. I'm wondering whether, with the potential costs of losing the species that we have, not nearly as obvious, that's almost impossible.
I'm not sure that the costs of biodiversity loss are less evident, actually, because it seems to me that the impact on food production could be quite severe. But, you know, I think you're right to point out the challenges of collective decision making with these problems where there are some short-term gains to be made, but the long-term consequences are slow and not always easy to observe and sometimes happen somewhere else. We've not shown ourselves to be any good, really, at making these kinds of decisions. You know, if that's the case, maybe we deserve what's coming to us as a species.
What about economists? Do they deserve what's coming to them? In other words, we've had the faulty measure of GDP. We've put it to the forefront for so long. Is there much likelihood of that changing?
I think it is changing. I mean, you're right to say, Peter, earlier that economists have been very influential and we bear a responsibility for the way that a certain kind of reductionist economic thinking has been implemented so widely in policies around the world. But I think economics itself is changing, at least in the academic world. There is a huge amount of work going on issues such as the environment and climate change and biodiversity, but also thinking more deeply about institutions and how those social structures affect economic growth. So a much broader range of questions. There is change and recognition of the need to step up to the plate, if you like. So I'm with you in saying that we have to bear our responsibilities, but perhaps a little bit more optimistic about how that might be changing.
I'm glad. Diane Coyle, Bennett Professor of Public Policy at the University of Cambridge and co-convener of the Wealth Economy Project on Natural and Social Capital. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
This is The Economists on RN with me, Peter Martin, and Gigi Foster.
There's more being done to value Australia's environment than you might think, and Jeff Summerhayes is at the heart of it. Until this year, Jeff was a board member of APRA, the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, responsible for regulating banks and insurance companies. Before that, he ran Suncorp Life, and now he is setting up mechanisms for companies to value emissions and the natural environment. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeff.
Hi, Gigi. Thank you.
On Tuesday, BHP announced that it was offloading its gas interest, and it's also planning to get out of thermal coal, leaving it with iron ore and coking coal. Why is it doing this, Jeff?
Well, BHP has been a leader in this area, and I think this move this week continues a trend of BHP's awareness about the importance of the transition to net zero. You know, the International Energy Agency recently published a pathway. This is a very credible, very conservative organisation. And on that pathway for the world to reach net zero by 2050 and limit global warming to somewhere under 2 degrees, they stated that no new oil and gas fields could be approved for development, no new coal mines or mines extensions to occur from this date forward. And I think BHP's decision fits within that context of needing to reorient the strategy of the business model and their resulting operations.
Is it the result of pressure from investors? The world's biggest investor, BlackRock, has said it won't invest in those sort of things. Perhaps pressure from bankers, perhaps pressure from insurers. And has APRA, the organisation you worked for, been, I don't know, part of putting those settings in place or applying the pressure?
It's a combination of all of those things, but the world is increasingly galvanising around that we cannot keep heating the planet and live life as we have done so without some radical transformation of how the global economy works. And firms like BHP recognise that, investors recognise that, particularly leading global investors. Regulators like APRA are understanding the potential risk that climate change has to the firms that they regulate. Our consumers get it. The courts and legal proceedings are now reflecting that. And so there is a range of stakeholders which are driving these outcomes. I have no doubt that investors are playing a big role, and investors invest in companies. They own these companies. They're concerned about the risk that these companies face in a world that that needs to transform from its current position, particularly companies that are involved in high carbon activities. And they're talking to those boards, to their executives, and they're making their feelings known.
What were you doing at APRA, the Prudential Regulation Authority? What kind of directives or discussions were you having with the insurers and bankers you regulate?
So APRA, along with the Reserve Bank of Australia and the conduct regulator, ASIC, we spent the first couple of years talking to firms about climate risk, how that risk was manifesting in terms of physical risk, transition risk in capital markets, and liability risk in the courts. And then more recently, the regulator has put out prudential guidance to the firms it regulates, that is the banks, the insurers and the super funds, about what they should be doing to address these issues. And that goes to issues like strategy, risk management, governance and metrics and disclosures.
So it sounds to me as though there is actually a kind of a disconnect between what the economics of the situation are right now in relation to investor preferences on the one hand, and then on the other hand, sort of the rhetoric of politics. So, I mean, do you think that it's this economic pressure that is going to be more determinative of what actually happens rather than what the politicians are saying?
Well, the weight of money is always very powerful, and the smart money understands what is required. They understand the transition, and the smart money is moving and investing accordingly.
It sounds to me like this is what you're describing is basically an informal kind of pricing mechanism. So it's built into now investors' preferences, consumers' preferences, insurers' preferences, that it's a little riskier or a little higher cost to continue with certain kinds of activities, and therefore companies have an incentive to change their activities. And that's kind of an informal price then that's being levied by the market. Are there also more formal mechanisms?
Well, I think there needs to be a range of mechanisms, and there are formal mechanisms. Australia is a signatory to the Paris Agreement, and Australia has its own carbon market, which is run by a government agency, the Clean Energy Regulator, and it has a fund called the Emissions Reduction Fund, and that fund buys quantities of carbon that are in fact called Australian Carbon Credit Units, ACCUs, and each ACCU is an equivalent of 1 tonne of carbon dioxide, either abated or not emitted. And so this fund is acquiring those ACCUs or equivalent tonnes of carbon dioxide not emitted from things like forestry projects, vegetation, waste projects and others. And so this is a formal government market that is run. The Queensland government is also setting up such a fund. There is another formal mechanism on which deals with compliance issues, which targets in Australia the 210 highest emitting companies, and then sets a benchmark for those companies about what emissions they can do. And if they exceed that, they in fact have to acquire offsets to mitigate against their emissions. And then there's a voluntary market where people are trading in carbon credits or carbon offsets as well. And this is where issues like natural capital and the natural environment as an asset class are now coming into the fore, because airlines, for example, are going to find it very difficult to switch away from aviation fuel, and an appropriate alternative hasn't been found. So there will be some into the future, some still carbon emitting industries, because there isn't a viable alternative, but those industries will then need to find appropriate offsets to mitigate against their carbon emission.
It sounds as if we have a carbon market, several carbon markets, and yet if you hadn't been paying attention, you'd think that the coalition government abolished the carbon price.
We do have a carbon market. In fact, that carbon emission reduction fund is just in this last period, in 2019, in fact, was just topped up with another $2 billion into that fund. Demand for the ACCUs or the carbon offsets has risen about 52% in this last year. The carbon spot price has gone up from about $18.50 in March to $23 today. And actually, quite interestingly, Peter, there has been a lot of activity by firms acquiring companies that have been generating carbon credits or offsets. And we're seeing companies like private equity companies like KKR and Adamantem, global firms like Shell, Mitsui and Mitsubishi have acquired Australian companies which have been cultivating and developing carbon offset projects, vegetation projects, waste projects and others. So this is quite a sophisticated market. It's very active and growing.
Does there also seem to be an appetite for offsets related to biodiversity, like we were talking about with Diane?
Natural capital and valuing the natural environment is something that we have globally taken for granted. We've always assumed that we could have access to crop soils, to harvest forests, to dump waste into the environment, to clear land, etc. And we are increasingly realising how sensitive the world is to biodiversity loss. That is linked very much to climate. In fact, it's often referred to as the twin crises between the climate crisis and the nature crises. So one of the areas that we need to do is to preserve and actually regenerate nature, because of the role it plays in biodiversity health of the planet, but it also this huge and significant role it plays in offsetting and helping to mitigate climate, because natural capital absorbs carbon. I mean, there's a lot of talk about developing carbon capture. I mean, the greatest carbon capture are growing natural things, grasses, crops, trees, and they are absorbing carbon on a minute-by-minute basis.
So soon farmers might be paid for having biodiversity of species and for absorbing carbon, which, as you said, we'll need to suck carbon from the air in order to get to net zero, because presumably we still want to take flights.
Absolutely. In fact, that's already happening, Peter. There is a growing awareness about more sustainable and regenerative practices on farms, and you can run a successful farm and grow crops, cultivate crops, graze animals, and then at the same time capture carbon. And the value of that capturing carbon by making sure that you keep ground cover, you keep tree corridors in your farm, you increase biodiversity, and the health of the soil and the health of your environment is able to be valued and sold. And Microsoft recently purchased a large amount of carbon credits from an Australian cattle operation where the practices on that farm were capturing carbon and storing carbon on that farm because of the way they farmed. That was able to be valued. It was able to be quarantined in a way that carbon was secure and not going to be released at some future stage, valued and then sold to Microsoft, who uses it as an offset for some of their other activities.
Very briefly, Jeff, is it happening quickly enough?
The evidence is no. I think this is an agenda which is moving incredibly fast. It's something that, you know, I have only been active in the last 5 or 6 years, and the change that I have seen as a regulator in that period is, you know, there has been a paradigm shift. This is not a watch and monitor issue. There's often talk about 2050. 2050, is too late to think about as a time frame. You know, literally the future of the planet will be determined by the actions we take out to 2030. And I appreciate that we're talking about economics here. But to be commercially successful, economies need to exist in a healthy, diverse environmental system as well. Those two things go hand in hand. And certainly some of the firms we talked about earlier in the interview highlight where there are a number of large and important Australian organisations that get that and are adjusting their model accordingly.
You're an optimist. Jeff Summerhayes, Senior Advisor at the climate advisory group Pollination, until recently on the board of APRA. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Gigi.
Head to The Economist website for lots of links related to Jeff Summerhayes, Diane Coyle, GDP, and the Descriptive Review of the Economics of Biodiversity.
And please send us your thoughts about this topic and next week's topic, big data. They know more about us than ever before. But maybe that's a good thing. See you then.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.